We're looking at the account of Moses, and last time we looked at chapter 16, just go over that a little, and then on to chapter 17. We have here a lovely picture of God preserving his people despite all the grumblings and their murmurings. God seems to have had trouble with his servants. Moses was a very reluctant leader, but he eventually obeyed, as we know. God enabled him and gave him also help. And it becomes more and more apparent as time goes on in these chapters why it should be Moses that is the leader and not Aaron. Aaron certainly would have made a mess of things if all had been left to him. And he has trouble with his people, and the amazing patience of God with his people. And although sometimes he's displeased with them, yet he is merciful to them again. Now, we have a kind of a running story here of complaints. Do chapels ever complain? Do chapel members ever complain? Have you ever heard a chapel member complain? No. Not at all, ever. No. I think we have, haven't we? We are made like that. We complain. And these are the people that we have here. Let's just look for a moment at chapter 16. And if you remember verse 3 to begin with, we'll just go quickly. And the children of Israel said unto them, would to God we had died in the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. And he sat by the flesh pots, and we did eat bread to the fill. For he had brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with a hunger. And they murmured. And do you remember the account as it went on? I may read a little bit. Then said the Lord unto Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. Now this they did. And they were supposed to gather before the Sabbath day a double portion so that they wouldn't be gathering on the Sabbath day. But they break that law. Now, God has provided for them, and despite God hears their murmuring, and he is aware of their murmuring, and murmuring displeases God. And I think this is something for me to remember anyway, and I'm sure you all feel the same. Murmuring is something we can all fall to so easily. We feel it isn't actually a rebellion. We don't feel it's open criticism. We don't feel it's been actually obviously unkind. But murmuring, a kind of a grumbling in the air, it is an unpleasant thing, something that destroys. Sometimes when you come into a room and you know as you go in that they have been murmuring, and it destroys any feeling of loveliness, and certainly it drives away the presence of the Spirit in that way. He was aware of this, but he is aware of also in verse 27, and it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found them. The Lord said unto Moses, how long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for that the Lord hath given you the Sabbath. Therefore he giveth you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide ye every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. And the house of Israel called the name thereof Manna, and it was like coriander seed, and so on. Now then, just a point as we go along, the keeping of the Sabbath day, for us the Lord's day, because we remember the day and the resurrection of our Lord and Saviour Jesus Christ, and there is a transfer in a way from the Sabbath of the Old Testament to the Sabbath of the New, where we remember our risen Christ. But it is a day set apart for God. Now, how important is it? Now, we know that perhaps sometimes those of us who are older, we remember how strict it was, you know, and almost to the point of being legalistic. And yet I never myself felt that, you know. I often did things I shouldn't as a child, or the children do, like go to a place you shouldn't. We were only allowed to go to the cemetery and back for a walk after Sunday school, and that was all, you know. But I always seemed to wander somewhere else. And but we kept the Lord's Day. People went to chapel and to Sunday school. It was morning, afternoon, and evening was the norm. Very few people didn't go. And if anybody did their washing on a Sunday, and they didn't, it would have been regarded as outrageous, you know. That was general in society. You know, shops were open, and the park gates were locked. And to make sure, the swings and the seesaws we had then were also chained, so that everybody got through the park gates, they would not be able to play on those. It was very definite that the council were in full agreement with these things not being used on the Sabbath day. It seems very strange and sure for the young people now to hear all that. And buses didn't run, you couldn't get a train either. So it was, you walked a long way. Even when I lived in South Lancashire, we had to walk 4 miles to the Welsh Chapel. 4 miles there, 4 miles back. You know, it was the Lord's Day. And some of you remember this, that everything that was going to be eaten on Sunday, all the big work, peeling potatoes and those things, done on Saturday nights. Do you remember those things? Am I the only odd person here? No one remember? Oh yes, you must have. You must have. And shoes were cleaned. Everything was done on Saturday, so that we, on the Lord's Day, it was kept. It was something you accepted. Lots of people made this an excuse later on, saying, I was put off chapel because I was made to go 3 times on a Sunday. I don't think those people were truthful, because it was something that was done. It was not questioned. You never thought it should be otherwise. That's how it was. That was the order of things. It was our way of life. Now then, it can become legalistic. And when a thing becomes legalistic, you're doing it almost in almost a critical way and a judgmental way, and watching if anybody else is breaking the Sabbath. You know, and it became very hard about it. And I never liked that. But I don't remember that at all. I'm sure it was to be hard, but I don't remember it. But when you do it because you love the Lord, it's different. It becomes a very lovely thing. We keep his day, and that we begin the week with him. We begin it with him. And in as far as is reasonably possible, that we do not things that are not necessary, and do those things that are necessary. I don't see any harm myself in buses and trains, that kind of thing. But, you know, we can go so much that it becomes ridiculous, I think, in the society we're living in today. But at the same time, we can work it out for our day, how we honour the things of God. Now, what stress would I put on it? Well, honour the person of God. That's primary, isn't it? Honour his name. See, these are in the commandments now, aren't they? Now, honour his person is pretty obvious. But honour his name. Now, when people blaspheme, they're not honouring his name, are they? You know? And it's a very bad thing to do. But we too must learn to honour his name. There is a way of using the name of the Lord amongst Christians very lightly, where they very quickly say, the Lord told me, the Lord said to me. You know, and what do they mean by that? You know, have they got a special thing that no other Christians have ever had, you know? And I think when it's done too readily and too quickly, that isn't honouring to the name of the Lord. And it's attributing to God something he has never said at all, only that they're expressing what they want to do. You honour his name. I would rather say, I believe that God is leading me. And I believe that God gave me this verse. I'd rather use it in a humbler way in order to safeguard the honouring of his name. Then there's the honouring of his day. Now, in a strange way, this is the only thing, apart from our lives now, I mean, of course, it's the only obvious thing that people see us do. You know, in the street, you'd be surprised how many people know where you are going at 10:30. You may never have met them or spoken to them, but they've seen you. Now, it's a testimony, you know. Whether you carry a hymn book or a Bible, that is interesting too. But in the evening, they know where you are going and that you're making your way to the house of the Lord. It is a reminder to the ungodly that God has his people. It is an open declaration. And also, that we keep it. It's sometimes very difficult to explain to our children, especially with the pressures today. People seem to hold parties, don't they, on a Sunday for children. And it's very, very hard for them, with their friends and so on. It's very, very difficult. And very difficult for a child to understand. But bring up a child in the way that he should go, you know. And they become to accept that we believe in God. And this goes right through our lives. There are certain things we will not do. And some churches have worked out what we can and cannot, and they brought it into a principle. What is allowed in what we call the regulative principle? Apart from the worship of God, deeds of necessity and deeds of mercy. But I'm afraid that latter one got abused in one area where I lived once. Because they did sick visiting on a Sunday, and they called it a deed of mercy. But they could have gone on a Saturday and didn't, right? But a deed of necessity and a deed of mercy, those are the things that are allowed. Otherwise, it calls for sobriety and godliness and joy in God and anticipation in the worship of God. Now then, the keeping of the Sabbath, and also how the church itself keeps the Sabbath, in how it worships God, to remember that it's God that we worship. Now here they are neglectful, and God is mindful of this, and that is highlighted. We say it was very, very difficult for them. They're in the wilderness. How do you keep the Sabbath in the wilderness? It's very difficult. And we might say today, we live in a wilderness of an age. It's nothing new, you know. Nothing new at all. God's people have always been in the minority, or mostly anyway. It's nothing new to live in a wilderness of a land. And to stand for the things of God has always been costly. And it has meant to many people much sacrifices, sometimes deprived of many things they would like to have had, because they have made this stand that they are keeping the Lord's Day. Now then, we call it the Lord's Day because it is his. Now you would have thought that was an end of murmuring. Well, it's not. In chapter 17, where we are tonight, and all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeys, according to the commandment of the Lord, and pitched in Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. It's pretty vital. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said unto them, "Why chide ye with me? Wherefore do ye tempt the Lord?" You see, he has in mind, they have been helped before. Can they not see that they will be helped again? Now, is this true in your life? And I'm thinking to myself, something happens and I'm bothered. And I allow myself to get really bothered about it. You know, really concerned. And then I remember, haven't you been concerned before? Didn't God help you then? Well, yes, he did. Then we say, but this is different. But it's not. You know, we can look back and say that we can testify to the loving kindnesses and the tender mercies of our God many times in our lives. I'll give you the kind of ordinary panic I have, you know. Take now preparing for Sunday night, which is not kind of... Sunday morning isn't so bad because you know where you're going. You're going to the next patch in the portion of the scriptures. And Sunday night is a gospel service. You have text here at different places. And sometimes you're going to have months and months where your text comes so easily with no problem whatsoever. And suddenly, stop. And I just can't find anything. And you see lovely verses, but nothing strikes you. Nothing strikes you. And you panic. I'd be going into the pulpit, I won't have anything. But I have learned on that one. Have you ever been without? I said, well, no, actually I haven't. Well, stop fretting then. And you know, immediately you stop fretting, it does come then. But can you imagine, you put yourself in my place now, and if you were in our chapel next Sunday, and it's getting on in the week, and nothing is striking, hundreds of texts, and not one of them is striking you, wouldn't you begin your temperature to rise, and your heart beat a little bit, you know? Unless you could say, hitherto, the Lord hath helped me. Put that into any situation in your life. He doesn't fail us. They forget, like we forget. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said unto them, why chide ye with me? Wherefore do we tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water. It's very real, you see. They're thirsty. And the people murmured against Moses. Now guess what they said? Have you any idea? Same old song. And said, wherefore is this that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? You know, it's a terrible thing to say. We'd rather be unbelievers. Speaking in modern ways now. We'd rather the pleasures of sin and enjoy and be comfortable than this living from hand to mouth. But you know, it's no exercise or sacrifice to us when that hand is God's. That's a wonderful thing. And if we can remember that it is God's hand that provides, then perhaps we react in a different way. So they are saying terrible things, as if we were saying, it was much easier before I was converted, it was much easier before I followed the way of God. How many demands are made? Why should I have to give money for this and money for that? Why should I have to give my time? My friends who are still in Egypt, this is where, they're enjoying themselves and they're not too bad and they're nice people. And we can argue like that and say, it's harder now than it was before. Well, of course it was. Of course it is. The way to heaven. And the narrow way, there are many afflictions on the way. But it is a good journey. It is a costly one. And it is not an easy one. You just read Pilgrim's Progress and you'll know something about that. Well, they thirsted and they complained. And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, what shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me. Poor old Moses, you know. I feel for Moses, you know. That remember now, you can say Moses was great and remembers the generations, but when he was there, he's only ordinary, you know? He's only ordinary. Like Martin Luther was just a monk, you know. He was only ordinary. John Calvin, a scholar, you know. But he was only ordinary that way. He had no idea, these people, no idea that they would have tremendous influence upon people to come. They couldn't see the future. They didn't know that. So Moses didn't know that he would be an example to many. And so he says to God, I'm really quite anxious. I think they're going to kill me. I think they're going to stone me. And there would be many thoughts in his heart, you know. Many thoughts. Why did I take this job on? Why did I ever enter the ministry? You can hear it, can't you? Why should I? Why should I have to put up with all this? I was perfectly happy where I was. And I was with a relative. I didn't dare go back, I know. But still, it was a life of ease and with my family. Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, what shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said unto Moses, go on before the people, and take with thee of the elders of Israel, and thy rod, wherewith thou smotest the river, take it in thy hand, and go. But this is a promise, you see. The rod, all right, this is fairly important in that sense. But what is important is this. Behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb. Now, that's the thing. You know, we could admit it all this and say, I'll take a rock now, go forward, you know. Like people with the 1904 revival, there's a famous prayer which was actually prayed by Joseph Jenkins and then repeated by Evan Roberts. He desired that God might bend to the world. He said, bend me, Lord. And hundreds of people, as far as I know, very sincerely have said, bend me, Lord, and expected the revival to come, you know. Well, that's not the way, not just to imitate the means that the person was told to use at the time. It's the God that makes a difference. You see here, it's not the rod, it's not the elders with him. I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb. Now that's the important thing, that God is there. And if I may put a little aside here, not in any way particularly critical or judgmental of the age that we are living in. We know a kind of age we're living in, and we know when we go on a holiday how difficult it is to find a place of worship where we feel at ease. Now then, it wasn't so difficult at one time. But you know, what is important in the church is not so much, you know, like we can argue about all sorts of things. I think things should be done decently and in order. I believe that, of course I do. But the important thing is God there, and the presence of God. You know, that should be really our greatest desire. And we can even do the correct things, can't we? You know, all the right things. And yet, you know, what is that hymn that goes, without thy presence, King of saints, our purpose fails, our spirit faints. So what we desire most of all in a congregation or in a service is the presence of God. And that's the direction I want to take us in these next few months, and God willing, in the camp of the young people. I'm hoping to take a series on what it means to know the presence of God and to identify the presence of God. You know, we've been so long without revival, so long before, without even the kind of visitations and times of blessing, that we have forgotten to identify what exactly is the presence of God, until we've thought it's working myself up, getting excited, all that kind of thing. Even good singing, and I like good singing, that's not the presence of God. You remember when the 1859 revival broke out in Treorthol, a village outside Aberystwyth. It had many wonderful meetings prior to that revival, and many converts, and we would have said that was revival, but it wasn't, you know. They were accustomed enough to in revivals to know when revival came. And then in a meeting there, which was not a particularly outstanding meeting, God came. And they sent a message to the General Assembly of the Calvinistic Methodists, a meeting in Flintshire, and they said, God is walking in his garden in North Cardiganshire. The difference between many good meetings, many series of meetings in different places, successful meetings, and a degree of the presence of God, but a great difference between this, you knew that he was there. How do we identify these things, and how can we learn? The answer for the age we are living in is to know that God has gone before us. We need to know that. And at the moment, I think, generally everywhere, we are floundering. So we need to learn to know more and more what it means privately and corporately to seek the face of God. Well, he said he'd go before them. And he told him what to do. And thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, and the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the chiding of the children of Israel, because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Now, can you imagine, you know, I don't think we can be as straight, can we, as it was in those days. Supposing that we were in a situation, and we say, well, we better change the name of our church What shall we call it? We shall call this year the year of grump. You know, like in China have the year of the frog and the pig and so on. You say, the year of the grump, the year of the murmurs, the year of the miseries, and the year of this and that and the other. I suppose many years could be titled as something like that, but we're not going to do it, are we? But it would be lovely to be able to say, the year of the Lord. The year when he came in a very special way. How do you do this? Well, you look at what Psalm 133. When the people have learnt that secret, brethren dwell together in unity. What's it like? It's fresh like the dew of Hermon. You know, it's like that. It's there. The Lord commanded the blessing. So there are great things to learn en route amongst ourselves as well. I'm not saying we're not trying. I'm just saying these are the things we should do. They called it that. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. Now, what problems? They had enough problems with themselves. I can't remember the hymn now. The hymn that says, troubles are fighting within and without, you know. And it's so, isn't it? Internal, you know, domestic and outside as well. Israel, as a church now, had many domestic problems. They were expert murmurers. And God didn't like that. But still, he was very kind to them, and very patient to them, despite their murmuring. But now you can have troubles from without. Where criticism, taking our age now, criticism from without, on an individual, in a family, or a church. And I've always found this to be true. When an individual decides really to go on with God, you find that many of his peers will mock. Even though they will half profess what he or she believes, they're not willing because it shows them up. When a church wants to pursue God, many churches, very close in identity, will criticize. This is, I don't think of any instance, I'm just saying this is always true. Always true. They will criticize. Why? They're always having prayer meetings there. They're always being godly. And then this awful remark, they're so heavenly minded, they're of no, remember, it's earthly use. But many are so earthly minded, they are of no heavenly use. See, where is our strength going to come from? Minister talking to me last week, a fine minister I know in South Wales, in one of the valley towns. And he said, you know, we've tried everything. But you know, isn't it time? I mean, we do all the right things, nothing wrong with that. But isn't it time that we got very, very serious and sought God as individuals, as families, and as a church? And as ministers as well, and so that there might be brotherly kindness amongst them, rather than the little things that can be sometimes, and seek the face of God. How vital is this day? Well, one day we stand before him, and we are answerable for the age we're in, and we've been put in a very challenging age. Why has he put us in this age? Why didn't he put you or myself in my favourite revival, the Beth Gellert one, 1817? Why did he put us there? Wouldn't it have been lovely to be in Beth Gellert then? Why couldn't he have done that? But he didn't, did he? Well, why couldn't he then stretch it a little, put me into the 1859 revival? You know, why couldn't he put us then? It would have been great, because there are no leaders today, therefore we'd have been much better off, because we have no leaders then. Or perhaps we'd have been better off in the 1904. But he has trusted us with 1998. He's trusted us. 97, 98, 99. You might say, well, Lord, what a trust. It's a wilderness. I know, Isaac. We are weak. I know, Isaac. But what's the answer for that one? His strength is what? Made perfect in weakness. Why? Then we shall not steal the glory and take it to ourselves. But we have been trusted with such a time and such an age as this. Well, there's a battle, trouble from without, never easy. And Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go out, fight with Amalek. Now, look at the practicalities we have here. Now, it isn't that they do anything. Many people will criticize our kind of church, or that they only think of revival, they don't think of anything else. It's not true, is it? Now, for example, door-to-door visiting is done, we do have open airs, we have a mission, we have all the things that we should do. But that doesn't spoil, does it? As knowing that the real answer, on a big scale, is the revival, we know that. And it doesn't take away. We're not doing those things instead of. We do those things anyway. Occupy till I come, you know. We do those things anyway. I don't stop witnessing just because I'm waiting for a revival. I don't stop preaching because I'm waiting for a revival. So you'll find the church that is seeking God in revival is also a very, very active church. And honestly, our church is a very busy one. They are active. But that kind of thing is levelled against them. You can say about Israel, oh, all they think about is God and having water and having bread and satisfied with the living water, satisfied with the living bread. And so long as they are spiritually fed, they don't care about anything else. And when there's a battle, they're just happy if they're fed. No. He sends out men to fight on the level of that fight. Choose us out men and go out, fight with Amalek tomorrow. I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in mine hand. Says, this is what I'm going to do. Take the strong men and fight. You know? It's as you might say, well, go into that arena with Martin Luther and debate with the papists. Or go with John Calvin into those great debates that they had and debate with those who are enemies of the faith. Yes, go on, do that. And so that you meet a person on the level that they're coming to you. And so here, he's telling you, go and do that, because and defend the people. But I tell you where I shall be. I won't actually be leading the battle in the sense you're thinking. I'll be on a hill over there. And I'll have this rod in my hand that God has told me to. Now, the people have been asking, well, is the Lord among us or not? Is God with us? Has he left us? Now, we could ask that kind of question today, you know, in saying, well, there's a dearth of converts, there's an occasional convert here and there. Generally speaking, there's a blanket of unbelief over the whole of these islands, as far as I can see and what I hear here and there when I go to places. And this is the general kind of heartbreak of ministers when they talk to you. And it's like that, and we might say, well, if he'd only give us some token, if he'd only show, is he with us or is he not? Has he forgotten us? Well, I believe we're under judgment at the moment, but I don't think judgment is because he's forgotten us, because he's teaching us. Will he ever forget his people? Do you remember those verses that say, will a mother forget a child? She may do, but I will not forget Israel. It's good, isn't it? We might forget many things that we say we'll never forget. But he will not forget us. Even though sometimes he deals in chastening and in judgment, even though he does that sometimes, he's doing it for a purpose. One thing he will never do, he will never forget his people. And that is a wonderful thing to know. You know, when you go to places and see how difficult it is, everywhere for that matter. So Joshua did as Moses had said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So Aaron and Hur, Joshua leads a battle, Aaron and Hur go with Moses. It's a lovely picture. And it came to pass when Moses held up his hand. Now, remember, the Old Testament way of praying was to raise your arms. Now, there was much more of the physical in the expression of worship in the Old Testament. There is a transfer in the New from the physical to the spiritual. And so you have, you know, rather than the various things that they actually did, they had they that worship me in spirit and in truth. And the Father seeketh such to worship him. So it becomes on a high level. But here it is physical, as well as verbal, of course. And it came to pass, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. And he went down his hand, Amalek prevailed. Now, why was that? Well, he's human. You know, he's human. You know, and to hold one arm or both arms up for a long time is a very, very difficult thing. There used to be in the old days a very unkind punishment. It was the period when I was a child, if you were naughty, that you had to hold your arms up. It was very difficult. And so the teacher told to put them down. I thought it would never be done today, but it was done then. But you know, it was the most tiring thing. You try it, well, I don't want you to try it. If you want to test it, you test it. And you'll find how heavy your arms grow. They're all right to begin with, and then they start getting as if they were lead weights, and they are heavy. Now, it's not really talking about arms, you know. He is, in a way, he's holding this rod up like this in his arm. And we're speaking physically to begin with. And you find that whilst he held his arm up, Israel prevailed. I got tired. His arm came sack lower and lower and lower, and Amalek prevailed. Put this in how we understand it. Here is the man of God, and he's battling. And he's praying. And the battle, real battle, is not down there, is it, ever. It's not at the critics, but the one who is behind the critic. It's not at the enemy. Is that the one who's behind the enemy? The battle is in the heavenlies. That's where the battle is. And we must begin to think spiritually so that when we are praying, we don't say X, Y, Z, that person, this, that, the other, but we go beyond and see the hand of Satan. And so it's a battle that is fought in prayer. It's difficult to pray long. It's difficult to pray with intensity for any length of time. And we find that the only time that we do pray like that very often is that when one of our loved ones is imperiled by some illness or some difficulty or some problem, and we find that we can agonize in prayer. But can we agonize in prayer for God's cause? Can we care enough for the church in the way that we care for our own? It is not easy. It is a very difficult thing to do. Well, here Moses is doing it. But he's human and he gets tired. But he had taken with him two men. And it came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he had let hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. And they took a stone and put it under him so that he could sit down. And he sat thereon. And Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, plural, the one on the one side, that it might really be good prayer now, the one on the one side and the other on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. It's a long battle. Now then, look at it. So they take a hand each. So before it was a little bit of this, you know, tired. Trying both, and down they sag. But this time, two strong men hold his arms up. Now, I don't know if the saying is in English, but I know we have it in Welsh. Well, I'll say it in English, because I don't know if it's commonly used, but it was. Holding his arms up. I don't know if it's said, you know. But we used to use it a great deal. Dal I frichu efo ni. That person's having a hard time. Well, it's better now. He's been helped. They're holding his arms up. They're helping him. And especially if a young man started in a church, you would ask the congregation, hold his arms up. And everybody would know what you meant. Do you see what I mean? Hold his arms up. What a great difference between murmuring and fighting and holding arms up. Now, that's the direction we've got to go. You see, if we go through the story of Moses now, you'll see there's a great deal for us here to learn, you know, as a congregation and as a people. Which way shall we go? What is the direction in this terrible wilderness? God will guide us like he guided his people, not with a cloud and a fire in those days, but he can guide us with his presence in a special way also. But we have to learn these things. He says there are going to be battles on the way. And some of these battles got as severe. You have to do two things. You have to know your doctrines. You have to know your scriptures. You have to be able to answer and give a reason for the hope that lies within you. You also need spiritual warriors. In fact, something you need to be both. But most particularly in the pattern of a church. I'm not speaking of myself now. The pattern of a church. You ask yourself, do I pray for my minister? Do I pray for him? I say, well, I do sometimes. Do I hold his arms up? You might say, well, I liked the minister before better than the one now. That's not the point. That's the one you've got. Maybe I like the one after better than the one I have now. That's not the point. You know, that's the one we've got. I can remember in the theological college, a very good man took 1 week, and it was a very difficult college to take any spiritual series of meetings, I can tell you. And he was a spiritual man. And he started off by saying something that challenged everybody. Many of you here said, I'll have my last fling before I go to a church, and then I'll be a godly man. Then I'll read good books. Then I'll read the scriptures. He said, if you're not doing it now, you won't do it then. That's right. It's the same issue with us. If we will not uphold the arms of whoever God has appointed in the particular church we're in, we don't do it now, neither will we do it then. All right? And that's why, you know, you have verses like, woe to them that toucheth the Lord's anointed. He might not always be to our liking. Might not always do exactly what we want him to do. You know. Sometimes he will make mistakes. We'll pray for him. But hold his arms up. That's the instruction. It's a good one, isn't it? Hold his arms up. To pray for him. These men are doing that. And it's shown here in a physical way. And so Joshua did as a... verse 12. Moses' hands were heavy. And they took a stone, put under him. And he sat thereon. And Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and then the other side. His hands were steady. I like that. His hands were steady. That is, his prayer was constant. What's he doing? He's prevailing in prayer. Why? Because he doesn't feel so alone. And you see, a calling like Moses is a very lonely one. A calling to any spiritual work, whether a missionary or a minister, is a particularly lonely one. The pulpit is the loneliest seat and standing place in the whole of the church. In another sense, it is the most occupied to the presence of God. But humanly speaking, it is the loneliest place to be in. And aloneness there. But when you know... Now, Spurgeon had, because his church was immense, there was a group of people in another room that prayed the whole time that he was preaching. You know. And I think some of our people too are praying most of the time. So we can listen and still have an attitude of prayer. What are we doing? Holding arms up. Why? There's a war on, right? There's a terrible war on. And we're also in a wilderness of an age where there are no standards, where governments set no examples, you know, and are not able to somehow, because they are products of the wilderness anyway. And we're in a wilderness. Yet we must honor God in the wilderness. We must honor his person, his name, his day in the wilderness. And we must hold up the arms of our leaders in the wilderness when enemies come against his church. Well, we find that here, steady. Joshua discomfited Amalek. Now notice, Moses is having this fight in the heavenlies, but Joshua is having victory on the ground. So you can't say, oh, they're so spiritual, they don't do anything practical like witnessing. Oh no, both are being done here. There's a spiritual battle going on, and there's a very practical battle going on at the same time. But they're not unrelated. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, he said, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. Now, he said, now, notice what he's doing. And it's a very strange thing that he's asking to do, really. He's saying, now look, I want you to make a record of this. People forget. Put it in the diary. Make a record of this. You have a diary where you put in God helped you. You know, we forget so very, very easily, or remember vaguely when he helped us. Look back in the diary and see how he helped you. Here he's told to do so. And he says, and by the way, when you do that, I want you to do this. And rehearse it, read it in the ears of Joshua. Now why? Can you see why? Joshua might say, I am a great warrior. I am the defender of the faith. I am the person who discomfited Amalek. The people of Israel should be very, very grateful to me. Not that I want to boast about it, but I won this battle of these people who came against God's people. So repeat it and rehearse it over and over again in the ears of Joshua. What really happened? How it really was? And why he won? Because the battle was won in the heavenlies. That is why a prayer meeting is important. You must hear remarks about prayer meetings. You say, well, it's long. It is sometimes. Is it very long? Others might say, well, that prayer is too long, that prayer is too short. I was reading in a magazine, a very good magazine this week, and it said this. This man was saying, I can remember, he said, in my particular denomination, when we used to support an induction service or whatever the communion services they had, it didn't matter if it was an Elohim preacher or a very ordinary preacher. We weren't there to seek God. You know. And we went to the house of the Lord, not selective in whom we listened to, but we went there because we went to worship God. That's the important thing. Now then, I wonder if heaven would let us into the secrets. How many of those who profess to be Christians in the churches in Wales today or in the whole of the islands, whatever you like, go to prayer meetings? I'm not saying they don't pray, but how many then begin to forget to pray? I think it's impossible to imagine a Christian who doesn't pray. How can we love a Lord we never talk to? Shouldn't it be that intimate relationship of prayer with God? You know, today, there are churches, many churches, that they... Well, I know how it happened, I can tell you. I come from a background of always prayer meetings in churches. And they're very happy about their prayer meetings. And the last church I was in, we used to have a week's of prayer at the beginning of every year. And what do you see? You call people to pray, a different tradition altogether. The minister invited people to pray. And the great boast was in our church there was that we never had to ask the same person twice. And we could go through the whole week. Church over there couldn't do it. No one over there couldn't do it. But we could go through the whole week without calling the same person twice. It was a kind of boast, but nevertheless, there was a prayer meeting every night. the prayer meeting was kept. There's no prayer meeting there now. How do you saw? Fewer and fewer and fewer. Then the announcement still goes on, you know, for a long time, that there's a prayer meeting. But there isn't. But the announcement goes on for a long time. And eventually, the announcement fades out as well, and there's none. Now, however successful that church may be, it has written out its own death warrant, hasn't it? It's broken communications with headquarters. Terrible thing. Terrible thing. You know, how many good Christian people never even think about the church prayer meeting. And I'm not saying that now in an judgmental or unkind way, but with the heavy hearts, the sad hearts. Because it means really we're not concerned, I'm not suggesting we put an answer, please, it's a dangerous thing, but it means that we're not holding spiritually the arms up of those who lead. So I say, well, I can't pray publicly. Well, that's all right, most people don't anyway. It doesn't stop us praying, does it? That prayer which is audible, and the inaudible prayer, as far as we're concerned, rises up to heaven like sweet incense. And I honestly believe that it makes a difference. I might say, what are the sovereignty of God? Well, yes, I include that too. But I do not exclude personal responsibility. Some of you remember one camp we had, and it was hard going. And I asked them to spend 5 minutes each day to pray for the meetings. That camp was transformed. And I had the idea then of doing that in our prayer meeting. Spend a minute or two praying for Sabbath preaching every day. And you know, we had a lot of converts. It had an immediate effect. Speaking humanly, I wonder if God is waiting. You know, sometimes when you're expecting a letter from a friend, and if it's a young man in love or a young lady in love, and they rush to see the postcard, no letter. Oh dear, no letter. 2 days, no letter. Then an eternity, 3 days, and no letter. And a week, what's wrong? Have they been taken seriously ill? What's wrong? Have they had an accident? Are they dead? 2 weeks without a letter? Something's wrong? Think of the heart of God. No letter today from that church. Well, there is one, but not signed by many of them. You know, the heart of God. Where is the pile of letters that I'm expecting? And he says, I love to have letters. I love to hear from my people. I love to hear of them thanking me for the good things that I have done to them. I love to hear them asking me when they know that I will help them. They're asking me. I love to have letters from them. It's another way of saying that our hearts are up. We worship him in spirit and in truth. And the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua. Now, this is then, if God answers our prayer, we don't go to a person who's converted and say, you know, I prayed for you, and that's why you're converted. Don't say anything. Or if their illness is relieved, don't say anything. Quietly thank God and give the glory to him. For I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar, and they called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. Now, what is the meaning of that? For he said, because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. That is, the Lord will keep them back. But his church must always be alive and spiritually alive. Things fade quickly. It's incredible. I've seen it, you see. They fade quickly. You know, it's like a lovely fire. We don't have fires today, but they are nice, aren't they? A lovely coal fire. And it's burning so brightly, and it's so warm. And you know, if parents went out on your age, you'd be like to say, look, now keep the fire in. You know what you meant by that, don't you? Keep it going. And a child or a young person might forget and read or something, and the parent comes back, now look at that fire. We must keep it going. We must keep it burning. We must keep it bright. That we must do. And in this place here, keep the light of the Lord bright. Keep the fire of the Lord burning. That we might learn what it means to prevail in prayer. Yes, to fight against Amalek on the ground level too. All that. So that Moses might say, God was merciful to us. And God says, you know, tell it in Joshua's ears. Because he knew Joshua. Joshua's young, you see. He might say, well, good. I preached well today. A terrific sermon. I was great. Rehearse it in his ears. That the victory belongs to me. It is a spiritual thing. And the battle is won when the church is praying for its pastor. Shall we do that? Now let us pray. Almighty God and our Heavenly Father, we thank thee for thy goodness to us, thy mercy as well. Protect our church. We thank thee, O Lord, for the lovely activities we have had recently. And we pray, O Lord, for every soul that shall interest, that we might fight this battle also in the heavenlies. And the battle altogether, O Lord, that we might become a spiritual and a godly people, not ashamed of being so, not ashamed of thine person, of thy name, or of thy day. Hear us, O Lord, for thy name's sake. Amen.